These bandanas make it hurt. Welcome to the Breaking Down the Bytes podcast. Interested in the IT field and looking for a way to break in? Are you a college student or looking for a career change? The IT industry is booming and has tons of opportunity. It's vast, complex, and can be overwhelming, but we can help. Come along as we break down some of the barriers as your insider to the tech industry.
Hey everybody, welcome back to this week's edition of Breaking Down the Bytes. As usual, I'm your host, Pat. You can find me on Twitter at Layer8Packet. That's the number 8. You can find Kyle on Twitter at Danith256. And if you want to tweet at Alex, just tweet the show at Breaking Bytes Pod. That sounds about right. So we're pretty active on Twitter, so come say hello. If you like the show, don't forget to subscribe on your streaming platform of choice. Kyle is MIA this week because of some scheduling conflicts, but Alex is here, and we have a guest. So I'll start with Alex. Hey, man, what's going on?
Yeah, nothing new. I know it's been a couple weeks because the Super Bowl took a break, but I'm excited because we have a former coworker and a subject matter expert in a topic that we talked about doing episode on probably as soon as I joined. So it's been months that we've been wanting to do this.
Yep. So, it's been a few months and we begged and begged. We begged and begged to find a Kubernetes or Docker expert, and we forgot about our good friend and former coworker Ryan Young. Hey, Ryan, what's up, man? How you doing?
Not too bad. Thanks for having me.
Man, it's good to be here. Thanks for coming on and spending a couple minutes with us. So this is going to be awesome. So Ryan, so a little backstory. Ryan, Alex, and I work together at Evolve IP. So it seems to be a theme here. We just keep plucking Evolve IP employees to come on and hang out.
There were some good ones there.
There were some good ones, and we're not done yet. So I have a few in mind that I want to pluck from the ether. So we'll see if we can get them to come on and agree. So we'll see. But Ryan, you and Alex and I were at Evolve. It was a great time. We worked on some really cool projects. We were all in different departments. We didn't really overlap all that much because of the vein that you're in, Ryan. But Ryan, you were like a mainly a Linux guy at Evolve,
that's
right?
That is correct.
Like Nodules.
And then later on, later on, we did a lot of the deployments as well. So we adventured into the DevOps space.
Cool. So Ryan, why don't you tell everybody who you are, where you're at, what you're doing, and where you'd like to go? Start there. Work your way out.
Yeah. So my name is Ryan Young. I'm currently a chief architect at SliceUp, which is a startup that does log analytics. Basically, we have an algorithm that ingests logs, and then it templatizes them, and then we can run analytics on. But mainly, my focus there is, you know, the deployment and the installation of our software. We're a software company, right? So a lot of DevOps type things. And when I first joined, they needed, you know, severely a deployment, you know, strategy, whether it's they had code, they didn't really have much of a DevOps space. So it's my job to, you know, get them up to speed, right? So I got them in Kubernetes. We are deploying, you know, natively to Kubernetes, building our Docker containers as well on the platform. And it just allows us to be scalable. So we currently have on-prem, but we are currently standing up a Red Hat OpenShift on AWS. So we're going to be a hybrid.
Okay. Cool. Nice. Yeah, that seems to be the way of the world these days. So, yeah, right on. Right on.
And I guess starting with that, we'll just take a step back. You already mentioned the keyword, Kubernetes. I don't know if you said containers yet.
I said Docker. I mean, Docker is kind of... You know, it's kind of it.
That's the golden standard, right? Yeah.
And I know Pat and I, we're certainly not experts. I haven't had much of an opportunity to work on it hands-on myself, even though it's used heavily at Disney. I'm not involved with it. So I'm always looking to learn some more. And I'm sure people that are listening to this may have no idea what containers are, what Kubernetes is. So before we dive into Kubernetes, I think it's probably makes sense to talk about containers a little bit. So I guess, Ryan, from your perspective, someone that's worked on it quite a bit, how would you explain containers to someone that is in IT but hasn't used containers, you know, like a network engineer who might not know it.
Yeah, it's basically the most minimal form of how to get your application installed. So a container in its deepest core is just fundamentally a small operating system with the bare bones minimum. It's less of an attack surface. There's less utilities there. So, I mean, there's no init system. So it's bare bones, whatever is minimally required to run your application. So it's a container that is all in one. So the application and the operating system both are in the same package.
All right. Well, yeah, I think that's a pretty good explanation from the get-go. I think it's pretty easy to understand. And it seems like it's gotten overwhelmingly popular recently. How long have you been working on it?
Since Evolve. I never stopped. So I want to say like 2015, 16, something like that. Because when I moved on from Evolve, every single company had a type of containerization platform or a container initiative. So I've had a lot of experience, whether it's in manufacturing or finance, a little bit from my consulting at Blue Century. So
all right.
I've had a lot of exposure.
All right. So you're the man to ask. All right. That's good. All right. I don't want to hog all the questions. I have several, but I'll go to Pat first. You have anything specific you want to talk about or anything that you want to know from an expert?
No. So I guess for some of the future things, because it does seem to be it sort of was a buzzword there for a while, and now it's sort of in the mainstream and saying, okay, look, this technology can be really useful sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So from a Docker perspective, and I've only had a little bit of experience with Docker, mainly just running a few years ago, I spun up a Docker container and ran my own little version of NetBox, which is an IPAM solution, but it didn't have to bug the server guys to spin me up a server and
right.
network and all this other garbage. I literally had a Docker container running on my machine inside some sort of flavor of VM. I can't remember what it was now, but it was basically it. And I just deployed it and it was there. I was like, oh, this only took me a few minutes. This is awesome. So, from that perspective, I could see that really getting big. Like once people wrap their heads around what it is and as far as like what it can do for people or do for business, I should say, I could really see a lot of customers or businesses going towards that because like you said, it's a small surface. It's the bare bones minimum. You know, you have a bunch of Dockers and then they, you know, it allows you to scale, you know, things of that nature. And then the Kubernetes comes in over top and is sort of like the conductor of the orchestrator, which are
right.
You know, the orchestra is the Docker containers, right? Each musician is a Docker container, and then the conductor of the orchestra is Kubernetes, and that's the management piece of putting things together. That's my understanding of it. So I don't even want to kind of go from
there. I always like to describe what, you know, you think of a container, you know, you always think of, you know, what is running inside that container. So if you have a simple container running a web server, you now need a port, right? So the Docker, you know, Docker came and then Docker Swarm, that really didn't really take off as an orchestrator. Basically, we had a whole bunch of microservices, right? And these are all running in different containers, right? Kubernetes is great because it takes the orchestration and it takes the things that most people hate to work on, no offense, Alex, networking and other things, and it wraps it up. It wraps it up and it makes it all nice and easy. So Kubernetes itself, I like to think of it as just orchestrating the platform itself. So like it'll orchestrate the containers. This container needs to run. This port needs to be exposed. And it kind of keeps track of that, you know, including the health checks. So that's, in my opinion, the best way to describe it. Infrastructure as code kind of goes with it as well, because everything can be defined as like YAML, if that makes sense.
So there is a programming language inside Kubernetes that sort of
So everything is
together. And it is YAML, is that right? Or can you use others? Just YAML is the
YAML is YAML/JSON, but YAML is what's used. Right. Kubernetes itself is custom resource definitions. So there's deployments and services, But what makes Kubernetes really useful for a lot of industry is that you can also tap into it, if that makes sense. So, for instance, traditionally on a deployment, you would have some kind of service, and you would push out and run some kind of commands, and it would invoke some kind of deployment on a destination, process. You know, whether that's Nexus or Jenkins, you know, initiating that. But nowadays, you know, with Kubernetes, it's all Helm or customized YAML definitions that basically you just change the image tag or change the code around that state. So in Kubernetes, you define what your state needs to be. So I want one pod running at all the times. So I want this health check running, you know, to make sure that pod is healthy and those type of things.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Before we start really deep diving, because I think we're starting to get there too, I did want to back up a little bit. It's something that I didn't know off the get-go, but there are quite a few alternatives to Docker. I think Docker almost has like the Kleenex analogy, where it's like, yeah, you say Kleenex when it's right. Really tissues, but
the tissue.
Docker's... When people think of Docker, they think of Docker containers, but there are more options than just Docker, right?
That is correct. Podman from Red Hat.
Okay.
And then there's Cryo from the open source community. I can't remember who's responsible for that one, but yeah.
And is it, in your experience, is it overwhelming Docker versus the alternatives, or how's that break down?
For the longest time, it was Docker, but now that Kubernetes has deprecated Docker and the Docker shim, everyone's going to Containerd and Cryo. So there's a shift going on right now.
All right.
Docker's a daemon, and it runs all the time. And alternatively, there are other least privileged type ways to do it.
So I've heard Containerd before. So what's the big difference or the big selling point of going with Containerd versus Docker?
From what I understand, less of a footprint from a security perspective. It needs less permissions to run.
Okay.
Okay.
And what are you using? You said...
I use Containerd, yeah.
Oh, so you are using Containerd.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is someone who never uses it, so I honestly don't know. I assume this is an open source. Are you have to pay for this?
No, well, open source. So our on-prem is 100% running the open source Kubernetes, you know, using the open source monitoring tools and things of that nature, and it's working great. Now, on the AWS side, we went with OpenShift because our client uses it, and we want to have an environment that looks like them just so we can support them. So that's why we're doing the AWS OpenShift. But in the end, it's all the same in a way. I mean, Red Hat makes it a little bit easier to do things.
So just to be clear, OpenShift is an alternative to Kubernetes.
Basically it runs on top of Kubernetes, so it adds a lot of monitoring. So basically when you deploy a Kubernetes deployment, there's a lot of second-day admin tasks that are required. You need to establish your monitoring stack. You need to establish your alerting. Your networking needs to be configured. So there's a lot of these second day tasks. OpenShift is the commercial version, I would say, of Kubernetes that do a lot of those second day admin tasks for you.
Okay. So they go hand in hand. So you wouldn't run OpenShift without running Kubernetes.
Exactly. Yeah. It runs the same daemon, the same API server and all that stuff.
Okay.
That's correct. Yeah.
And for someone who doesn't use it, and is not sure, is there like a certain level of environment, a certain number of containers before it even makes sense to go towards this orchestration model? I mean, like at what point?
It does. It really does. Yeah, because I've had customers come to me and be like, you know, I have two pods and I want to run Kubernetes. And I'm like, why? Why do you want to run Kubernetes? We actually ended up on Fargate using AWS. So, I mean, it sometimes doesn't make sense to go full Kubernetes. It all depends on what problem you're solving, right? If you're trying to, as a startup and you only have like a web server and maybe an API, it may make sense to use one of the serverless computing options that like AWS or Azure has. It's the same container. It can run that same container being spun up on those platforms can be run on Kubernetes later if you do grow. But I mean, if you have a small footprint, I would not recommend. Because like at a core, Kubernetes is scheduling and keeping track of all these little deployments, right? If you don't have a lot of these little deployments, it really doesn't make sense.
Okay. And you use the term pod a few times. So what would be, if you had to define like a Kubernetes pod, like is that just a collection of containers or what exactly is a pod?
Basically, yeah, because a pod can contain one or more containers. So like, for instance, I can have some kind of API service that potentially could run something before that to initialize. So they're called init containers, or you could have sidecars containers. So for instance, one deployment usually can create pods, right? And those pods create containers. So like, for instance, I can have an Nginx deployment creating 10 pods. It'll create, you know, the 10 containers. However, if I have an init container on those pods can contain one or more. Does that make sense?
I think it does for most people.
Okay. Yeah, it can contain one or more containers, depending on how you are. But yes, at the simplest form, it's one container.
Okay.
And then you also have stateful sets as well. Stateful sets are stateful applications, think databases or Kafka, those type of applications that don't like to go up and down. They have to maintain some kind of state.
All right. Cool.
Makes sense.
All right. Again, I don't want to hijack all the conversation, so I'll let Pat add some things. You did mention AWS Fargate. That's probably something I want to touch back on. So, but before I do that, I'll see if Pat has anything he wants to ask.
No, I just had one thing, and then I'll kind of talk about some of the cloud flavors of the big three. So with the way the Kubernetes kind of lays out and manages said Docker containers, from my understanding, there's an applet called is it a kubelet? Is that what it's called? So mm-hmm. That basically runs within each pod or container. Node. And you can think of a node as just basically a server, right? That kind of thing.
Like it could be an EC2 server, it could be a VMware or a physical server. And they can have different attributes as well.
Right. And so as far as like the scalability, as far as saying, oh yeah, you lose one, you know, how do you replicate or, you know, what that kind of thing. Like, does that have, is there like a health check mechanism of some sort that this thing checks in? Is it all an API call from the kubelet app
back to
Kubernetes, like the control plane? So what's controlling the health to say, okay, yeah, you're down, I have to replicate over here or manage those pieces?
Yeah, the kubelet basically accepts things from the API server. So the API server, okay, so I might have this. I got to think here. It's been a while since I've dealt with like the interworkings of the Kubernetes, like deep down, because there's an API server, there's a scheduler, there's a kubelet. The API server accepts basically, you know, API commands, you know, a system admin requesting, you know, a new deployment. And then you have the scheduler that basically checks in, that makes sure that the state of what is in code matches what's actually happening.
Right.
So let's back up a little bit there, right? So that's, I always say this wrong. I think it's idempotent, basically, Kubernetes is. So I defined in this YAML file, I want X deployment in this container using this name. I want this many resources. That's all defined. But the scheduler makes sure that what is defined and actually versus what is running. So if a application randomly crashes, that thing, the scheduler is going to say, hey, I need to reschedule this one pod, replicas equals one, I have zero ready, let's fix that, right? And then the kubelet's going to say, hey, I need a pod, let me run. And then it starts off the process, right? But it's a little bit more than that, because the API server also handles other type of things like load balancers to establish connectivity inside the cluster, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. I was wondering
the actual health check mechanism was.
It depends. Like if you're talking nodes, the kubelet server checks memory, checks disk space, CPU. So one of the beautiful things about Kubernetes is the scale. When you take down and look at the container definition, there's a thing called resources. You know, how many resources your container uses. These values are enforced, but also they provide clue to the scheduler where to put your workload. So for instance, if I have 16 nodes and I'm trying to schedule a container that's going to have up to, say, 4 gigabytes of memory, it's not going to schedule that on something that's, you know, 80% full memory. It's going to choose a guy with like less memory use. So it's important to have like resource limits defined so that all works correctly. But that's the nature of how the scalability engine of Kubernetes works. You know, you define your limits and you define all what is required. And depending on the environment, it could be on node number one or your container could be on node number two. It all depends.
Cool. That's interesting. So turning the conversation into a little bit of the cloud stuff, right? I know, you know, we talk about cloud on this show quite a bit because that's where, you know, things are ultimately moving. So that's a hot topic pretty much all the time. But it seems to me like the AWS, the GCPs, and the Azures of the world, they have some sort of managed Kubernetes service. Like, is that like, can you run your, I guess, because it is open source, can you run your own Kubernetes inside? Just put it on the cloud bare bones, or is it a managed service or nothing in each of the clouds?
The beautiful thing about these cloud, you know, offerings is that they take a lot of the manageability that you have to do like on-prem, and they take that out. So the control plane is basically one of the main things that they take over the management of. To upgrade a Kubernetes cluster in the cloud is you got to make sure everything is fine, you know, as far as deprecation warnings and stuff, and then you just click a button and it'll upgrade the nodes and all that. So you're basically in the cloud paying for the control plane and then the compute, right, if that makes sense. So each one has two slightly different offerings and they're confusing. One is a full-blown like AWS EKS, which is your Elastic Container Platform, Kubernetes basically. And then another one is basically just apps, like serverless. The buzzword is serverless. I never liked the name because you still got servers, but it's basically running Docker containers in a way, or on Fargate it would be. Azure has apps. I don't know what Google Cloud has. Yeah, these same containers, though, they will run anywhere. So if I build it on my on-prem instance, I can ship that to AWS, and it'll be just fine as long as the configuration matches what it's supposed to. For a startup, you know, that maybe you want to run your small application and you don't want much footprint, it makes more sense to use the serverless app model because you can utilize the same infrastructure later on in if you outgrow that, if that makes sense. For instance, a startup wants to run maybe 3 containers for their application, and then later on they need caching or they need this and that, and it just starts to become more. You can take that and then move it off to a more scalable platform. But that's the main difference. So the same container basically can run on either platform. It's just one is designed to run a few and one is designed to run a lot.
That's interesting. So I know you say you didn't like the term, but it's a term that I still struggle with today. So with serverless compute or serverless offerings that just stick with AWS that they offer, when they say serverless, what they mean is they're running their version of Docker or whatever it may be. You're just coming with containers. Is that for the most part? Or yep. Is there any other option for that?
Pretty much. I mean, there's Lambda and stuff like that. The way I like to look at serverless is they provide the runtime, you provide what gets run, if that, you know. So like I provide the container, they provide the Docker used to run that container.
And another thing that I'm kind of unsure of is if you're talking about serverless specifically, or even if you're talking about Docker, they're running, that's what's running the Linux kernel. And you as a container, you can just run any Linux instance, right? I mean, you can't just throw a Windows mm-hmm. boxer in there. Or what do you have to do if you want to containerize Windows?
So I'm just going to be honest. I have avoided Windows my whole entire career, including Docker. So I know that it's supported in some way, shape, or form, but I just have no experience.
he's coming clean here on this podcast. I like it.
Yeah, I don't know how. So I don't know how I did it, but I've managed to avoid Windows. Like, even when I was working at the pharmaceutical company, I had a Mac. Okay. Yeah. So I don't know. I can't really tell you. I do know that it's supported. I just don't know to the level of what.
Okay. So I guess a Linux kernel is a Linux kernel. Coming from a Linux guy, is there ever a limitation that's going to come up based on what kernel they have, or they're just going to run the newest one, and because of that, you can run whatever you want?
I mean, if you want to get technical, there are instances where if you're running too old of a kernel and you have too new of a glibc library, I could see you having a problem, but I haven't ran into that.
And when you extract something, like you're extracting, the whole idea, we're used to VMs that are running their own kernel, their OS, their home little, I can't use the word container, but they're running everything. Now you're extracting it, you're taking the kernel out, and you're putting that in something else. Where does...
Well, you're not technically running, you use the same kernel to run all the containers.
Right, okay.
What makes containers awesome is that they use overlays. So if you think of a traditional operating system, you have your C drive, mm-hmm. and then you could probably add storage and things of that nature. But with a container, you base your container image on something, whether that is a Ubuntu image or a Red Hat Enterprise. And then any modification that you make, there's a new layer. So, for instance, the beautiful thing about this is that it saves space. If I'm updating my web application 600 times in a development environment, truly the only thing that gets changed is maybe the outer layer or the second outer layer, you know, the actual HTML code. But all the other workings, it all lays the same. It saves space that way. If you base images off the same OS, it really helps there to save space as well. So everything, if you look at it from a storage perspective, containers are kind of like, they're like overlays. Okay. Like you have one layer, it's like an onion, and then you have another layer, and then another layer, and then finally the last one, and then that runs.
Okay. Well, yeah, maybe this is something we should have started off with this, because I guess it didn't really come right out and ask the question. So you already talked about how containers are going to save you storage space in the long run. What are really the big reasons to run containers? Like, why would someone run a container versus a VM? As simple as that.
Easier to keep track of applications as opposed to infrastructure. So what does that mean? Like, a container has one purpose. It's easier to keep track of that one purpose. Multiply that by, you know, if you have a huge company, say like Netflix or Disney or I don't know, whatever, you have a lot of different applications. You know, you have an API that access this, and you have a authentication API. You have all these different microservices. This will keep track of all of those little nitty bitty problems like that could come up. You know, an API server gets overwhelmed because someone's clicking F5 a bunch of times, like, you know, like a DDoS attack or whatever. It crashes and it'll just restart. It'll self-heal. That's some of the advantages of running containers. If you take the traditional deployment method of you start with a VM and then you deploy your VM, you deploy your software, your operating system, you configure it and all that. That is the old methodology of application deployment. New age application deployment is you just basically build your container. So how do you build your container? Each container has a Docker file. This is a set of instructions in which that container runs or copies files, things, you know, copies the files to or builds, and that ends up getting run. That's what gets saved and stored and then later executed. I don't know where I was going with that.
At least you're
honest. No, that's fine.
I'm severely ADHD. You're gonna have to deal with that. I've always been ADHD. I don't know where the fuck I was going with that. I'm sure you could use it some way of what a container is.
Be honest about it. I like it.
I mean, it's the next evolution of VMs. So, you know, 20 years ago, you had a server for every single purpose. Then the next huge just game changer was VMs. Now you're taking a single, you know, bare metal and you're breaking that into however many VMs you have. Now you're breaking up a VM and breaking up into individual applications.
Yep.
So a container, I'm trying to think of like how granular a container gets. And maybe this is a bad example, but say you have some application that just runs your email. Is there potentially lots of containers that serve the purpose of email? Or is there going to be like just one container that does everything related to email?
No, it's a microservice approach, right? So, you know, a modern application, it has, you know, mainly more than one component. It's no longer a monolithic application that you start, at least in terms of, you know, back-end web. You know, there's usually like a database, there's usually an API, you know, and as your application becomes bigger and more evolving, the microservice approach has taken off, right? So instead of making a monolithic application these days, you have an application that does an API for that specific use case. And then if you need to have a new application, you either expand your API or you have a new container that is responsible for a different type of API. In the modern approach, if you have an application that aggregates stock or stock prices, you know, you'd probably go have an, I'd have an application, one web app to scrape this data source, have another one to do this, and then you can scale that horizontally, right? So with the microservice approach, you know, if you have an application with that approach and you have, say, users are having a hard time logging in, well, I can just scale that application, that pod up to ensure that the amount of requests being requested are being met, right? So it has a lot of like auto scaling capabilities for modern web apps. It's a whole different architecture. So if you say, okay, let's circle back, because a lot of my consulting days were trying to take existing applications and putting them into Docker container.
Okay. Yep.
So a lot of people want to get into the container space. The, you know, traditional monolithic applications, they want to slowly move into the Kubernetes realm for deployment or whatever problem they're trying to solve. The most successful migrations that I've been a part of is that they've had to modify the application. A lot of old school applications were defined that, you know, needed modifications when you started up, or they needed files changed. And in a container, you don't necessarily always have a read-write file system, okay? So you can start a container up and say, I cannot execute any file, I mean, write any file unless it's been told where it can, right? And a lot of those monolithic applications that I've come across have had to be modified, whether to write to a specific directory or, you know, getting configuration from environment variables as opposed to static configuration. So, I mean, take the when people, you know, go into containers and Kubernetes, you have to ensure that the problem that you're trying to solve is solved by Kubernetes. That's what I'm trying to say. So if you don't have a microservice approach of an application, maybe a container isn't for you.
Okay.
So if you have like a Java app and it's very like monolithic, like you can only, for instance, right? I've seen applications where you can only have one running at a time, right? That's anti-Kubernetes, right? Because it's going to cause state issues and other type of things. So I caution anyone that does have, from a migration perspective, to always look at the reasons why you're going to Kubernetes and to make sure it makes sense from a business perspective, to make sure that what you're trying to solve is truly for Kubernetes. Because, I mean, I've seen a lot of areas where they're trying to put an old application that just doesn't belong inside a container.
Yeah. So say you're like a contractor for a company that CTO maybe knows enough to be dangerous, and he just heard the buzzword Kubernetes, and now he wants to run containers and Kubernetes. What are some of the questions that you would ask to even to make sure that that's the right approach? Like, what are the first things you're asking, the first things you're looking for before you even go, yeah, that makes sense?
What type of application it is? Is it stateful? Is it stateless? Is it going to be running in the cloud? Is it going to be running on-prem? Those type of questions. So if it's a microservice, I would recommend a container approach. It makes everything easy from a deployment perspective. I'd also ask what the application is for. Is this designed to run for your own customers, or are you providing this to someone? That makes sense. That matters as well. Shipping containers for Linux in today's world is easier, in my opinion, than shipping any other kind of package.
Well, even a VM.
Yeah, so if I... It's easier and faster for me as a Linux guy. Say I need, you know, an invoice service. I'm going contract, right? I'm 1099 or something. And you need to keep track of your invoices. It's easier just to start running a couple containers. You know, you have a database here and an invoice web server here that, you know, and you're ready to go. You know, from a deployment perspective, it's a lot easier. Again, from a microservice approach, if you think of what a microservice is, it's usually a stateless application that either connects to a database to retrieve information as an input and outputs information some way. So if it fits that type of model, then Kubernetes and containers is right. Okay. You know, but I'd question, you know, when you migrate versus starting fresh, in my opinion, it matters a lot. Some applications are easier to migrate than others, you know. But if you just hear a buzzword of Kubernetes, you know, I would like to find out, you know, why you're going into that way. What problem are you solving?
Right. It always starts from you need to solve a problem, and can Kubernetes do that or not?
Exactly. So the ideal candidate, you know, for SliceUp, we have an Apache Flink and Kafka. We run that in Kubernetes because it's highly scalable. So Kafka is just a system that I call it like a pipeline. It's an input output. It has topics, but you can scale that. So Kafka itself, you know, you have one pod. You can actually add brokers as the volume increases, right? With Flink, you can add task managers as your volume increases. So with Kubernetes, it helps from a microservice architecture, because, you know, we process a bunch of logs. So in an environment that's a school might not have as many logs as, say, NASA would, you know. So if you have a scaling problem, that is one of the one main benefits of Kubernetes.
Because you're standing up a lightweight container versus pretty heavy VM.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because think about what you have to run on top of, you know, your operating system. You know, you have a backup software these days, and you have authentication, you have monitoring tools, you know, and it just goes on and on and on. And then that RAM usage, each time you want to start up, it becomes greater and greater.
Okay.
That makes sense to me.
All right, Pat, I'll hand it over to you. I think at this point, we might want to start asking maybe the future Kubernetes, things that might want to
you
see
read my
different.
Mind. That's exactly okay. What I was going to see. See, this is why.
Okay.
This is why we work so well. I was going to ask that. Yeah. So, you know, as we all know, right, the cloud is obviously here, and it's you know, kind of driving business today, instead of, you know, kind of, you know, begging from behind, it's now leading most things and sort of what mm-hmm. you know, that kind of entails. But where do you see the future of Kubernetes or Dockerized, or I should say containerized technologies kind of going? Like, what's the trend? Like, do you see a trend moving forward? Like, yeah, you know, you're a little closer to it. You're a lot closer to it than Alex and I are. So in the network world, we can kind of see some trends coming and say, okay, yeah, this is probably going to be really big in the next, you know, 5 to 10 or 2 to 5, whatever it is. Do you see something that is a major, like, oh, there's a pie in the sky. That's going to be huge in 5 years.
Well, Kubernetes is huge right now, and it's only going to get bigger. Right. Because if you look at today, like if I were to create a company from scratch, right, I'm more likely to going to go towards a Kubernetes/cloud platform, because when you start a company, you don't want to have the problem of ordering infrastructure and hardware and other stuff. So sure. I feel that the future is going to be huge in the cloud. Yeah. People are going to worry about applications as opposed to, you know, their infrastructure as a whole. You know, infrastructure as code between cloud providers. I see a lot of huge multi-cloud strategies about being the future for a lot of companies.
All right. So what are the type of positions you think are going to be less important down the road and positions that are going to be more important because of this trend? Like, what's the title that you'd be scared of right now to have given the future?
VMware, but I mean, I also see, like, from huge, heavily compliance industries, you're always going to have those guys that need to be, you know, on-prem and things of that nature, just because of the, depending on the industry. But yeah, I'd be worried about VMware and on-prem. But, you know, the new exciting thing now is data analytics, you know?
That's interesting.
Whether, you know, data scientists and making AI and all that. So,
yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, the data analytics seems to be, you know, obviously big data. It's been around for a while. Yeah, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. I would say the future, I think, is multi-cloud and ensuring that your just application runs no matter what, whether that's, you know, in AWS or whether that's in Azure, a different data center, or even on-prem, you know, the agility I feel is going to. Because, yep. I mean, how many times has AWS had an outage, you know?
Right. Yeah, that's interesting, too. The multi-cloud is something that I've heard from a few people try to, you know, say, hey, we're going to do multi-cloud, or at least, you know, that's the future sort of thing. So I am curious on, you know, say you're in AWS and you're running, you know, you're running the EKS, right? The AWS EKS, right? A lot of acronyms here. And then you also have an Azure presence. You're running, you know, their managed, you know, Kubernetes service, AKS, right? Whatever they want to call it.
Yeah.
Yep. So, and they, you know, so how do you blend those together, right? Because they're in different ecosystems. I think that's going to be a big one in the next,
and then also
try to solve, right?
How to keep it all managed,
right?
Each platform, you know, Google, AWS, and Azure all have different tools, different tool sets. Yeah. How do you aggregate all that data to make sure that you're monitoring that platform and monitoring everything and all that?
Yeah, the monitoring thing is interesting to me, too, or I should say the manageability of the Kubernetes is an interesting thing to me. Can you use like a Terraform or something to manage the Kubernetes side, or is there
in the cloud? You can, okay. Yeah. That's how for EKS deployments. That's what I prefer to use is Terraform, because everything's infrastructure as code. And then when you go to the Kubernetes space, you can utilize a tool called Argo CD. Okay. And what Argo CD is a fancy word of saying GitOps. It's a tool to do to GitOps.
Okay.
I love the tool. It's my favorite tool. It basically monitors a Git repo for changes and then rolls those changes out on the Kubernetes platform. So,
nice. And I know in recent years, you know, things like Ansible, like playbooks, runbooks, whatever you call them, that they've been popular as well. Terraform, obviously, you know, we mentioned that's popular. Can you run Ansible in, you know, with Kubernetes as well? Is there like what's the integration with that? Is there an integration with that? Because, like I said, it seems to be very popular and easy to read with the playbook, blah, blah, blah. You just deploy the playbook or runbook, whatever you want to call it, and it does its thing. Like, is there a usefulness there as well?
I think not so much Ansible with Kubernetes, but you could use Kubernetes to run Ansible. So okay. I'm in the DevOps space a lot. So, like, it's very common for me to have Jenkins jobs to make my life easier. So
sure.
I have a Jenkins job to configure SSO that uses Ansible. And the beautiful thing to me is I don't need an operating system that has Ansible on it. I tell Jenkins to start up using Kubernetes an Ansible container.
Okay.
You know, and so And that is powerful because you can use infrastructure as code. You know, you utilize Terraform, deploy your EKS cluster, and then utilize Argo CD or any other type of tool just to install. You can even use Jenkins just to, you know, configure your builds and configuration within Kubernetes. It's very powerful because you can just pick a container and it has the tool set in. So you could technically use Jenkins to run Terraform within Kubernetes.
Okay.
And that's very popular to do because if you think about it, GitLab Actions is running Docker containers. So pick the Terraform container and you got the creds and you're up and ready and running the whatever you need to run. You know, yeah, so yeah. Yep. So that's very common. I'm glad you mentioned that because like all the modern CI/CD tools utilize containers. GitLab can. You just pick a container. It has your tool set. It's running.
Cool. Very cool. Anything else from you, Alex?
Yeah. The question I had, and I think it's probably a good way to end the conversation because I think we're getting close to the hour mark anyway, is we made it clear this is where everything's going right now. You're going to be in a bad state if you don't know this stuff pretty well in the next few years. So having said that, people that are interested in learning this, do you have any suggestions about where people can even start? So I know you've been working on it for years and maybe you kind of just naturally got a chance to do some hands-on stuff and have grown into the expert you are now, but any suggestions for people that may not have the ability to work on this at in their current jobs? Like where do you even start?
I would start with a Kind cluster, K-I-N-D. Kind create cluster will have it basically starts up a Docker container and it creates a small Kubernetes deployment that you can deploy to on your local laptop. It uses low resources. It's a modern version of Minikube. But Kind, it just is a little bit better because you can do you can simulate multi nodes by having Docker, more than one Docker container as a node. And then you can also test different networking device, networking plugins as well. It's an easy way to get started.
Cool.
Okay. And you said that's Kind, K-I-N-D, right?
Mm-hmm. That's what I like to use.
All right. Well, yeah, I'm gonna take that as a resource. Yeah, the idea of being able to run it locally on my laptop and play around, I like that.
Yeah. And then you can shut it down that easy too. Like a real good one. You can do a Kind delete cluster and it's gone. You know, and you don't have to worry about any resources.
Cool. Yeah. I like it.
Well, this might be the all-encompassing thing to start with. Anything else you can think of? If not, we'll certainly look into Kind.
I would say building Docker containers is a good start as well. There's a lot of good resources out there. Just Google is mainly the one of them. But learning how to build a Docker container and running them just different ways you can invoke them. Like you can have a Docker container being ephemeral, meaning you can start it up and then as soon as it's gone, it deletes itself. I would just learn the in and out of Dockerfile. That's what I would recommend.
Nice. All right.
Nice.
Well, I think that's all I have, Pat. You got any ending questions?
No, that was pretty much it. And I'm just looking here. You know, Pluralsight seems to have a Kubernetes course there. CBT Nuggets has a Kubernetes course, Certified Kubernetes Administrator, CKA. That's there as well. So, you know, check out, you know, some of those. We're big fans of CBT Nuggets and Pluralsight and INE here. So anything from a video perspective, if you're just kind of testing those waters, they do have courses out there. So go and pick your platform of choice and get to learn. But yeah, Kind seems to be a good place to start. Docker, also another good place to start and kind of work from there. They have all kinds of documentation there as well. So real good stuff from that perspective. So yeah, that was pretty much it. So, like I said, we're right around that hour. We'd like to keep it nice and relatively short and get on with your day. And we appreciate you joining here. So, we're going to wrap this one up. So, yeah, thanks everybody for joining this week on Breaking Down to Bytes. Make sure you visit our website, breakingbytespod.io. You can subscribe to the show from your platform of choice, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or if you just need a plain RSS feed, we have one there too, so you never miss a show. Give us a rating on iTunes. Follow us on iTunes. That would be great as well. Or simply tell a friend, right? That works just as good in today's technology-connected world that we seem to be drowning ourselves in, right? Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Breaking Bytes Pod. Facebook's out there. Discord server is out there. The invite for the Discord server is in the show notes. Our survey is still out there. That's also in the show notes as well. Survey is completely anonymous. It's like 9 or 10 questions. We just aggregate answers and a couple of questions on there and just give us a little feedback and make sure we're doing the right things and giving you the content that we that you enjoy. So that's it. Ryan, man, this has been awesome. Really appreciate you hanging out.
Thanks.
For a couple of minutes, man. This has been really cool. We'll definitely have you back. Talk some other nerdy Linux stuff in the near future.
Sounds good, man.
All right, buddy. Thanks again. We'll see everybody next week.